Thank you for having me back again. I hope, now that I'm in the Toronto area, I hope to make my visits more regular. I'm happy to tell you about this recent work that I just completed with my collaborators, Patrick Fox, Kevin Kelly, Pedro Machado, and Laurent Blested, where we try to come up with a scheme, or realistically a code, which we call Petite, to more accurately model signals at fixed target experiments. So just to bring everyone to the same page, fixed target experiments is a really old experimental concept. It's basically shooting a beam of standalone particles at a target that's stationary. They come in many different shapes and sizes, where the detector is close to the target, where the detector is itself a target, maybe the detector is very far away from the target. But this is really one of the oldest tricks in the particle physics book of tricks. If we look at if we look at history, some of the earliest discoveries in particle physics, including the discovery of nucleons, substructure of protons, all were done with fixed target experiments of different kinds. In the 60s and 70s, people started to collide beams of particles, and colliders took over eventually, but people were still using fixed target experiments to search for sort of beyond standard model physics. I particularly love this proposal from an old Slack experiment, which is very honest. Well, they say they propose a speculative experimental program which has a high probability of yielding no success or yielding no significant result, which is very honest. And I think everyone should, we should all be that honest. But this wouldn't fly with funding agencies today. So we have to be much more optimistic about our discovery prospects. So this is, it's a very old experimental program, but it's still going. So here's a snapshot of the landscape of experiments from the Snell mass process in the States just from last year, which shows the rough timeline. Note the no units on the timeline axis and the various facilities that are either operating or will be operating in the future. So I just feel everything I want to take away, I want you to take away from this is that there's many experiments that are either planned or currently being done. So if this is such a well-trodden idea, why is there all this activity? And this has something to do with some fairly recent, like in the last 15, 20 years or so, realizations that have to do with these three things, which I'll kind of use as motivation for thinking about precise predictions for fixed target experiments. So first, people realized that you can use these experiments to probe kind of the leading order, so namely lowest dimension connections to a standard model of new light particles. This is a lot of this work was done by Maxime in the mid-2000s and early 2011s or 2010s. Something that I've worked quite a bit on was considering various models of light dark matter that we produced in these experiments. And these are very simple models which you can really definitively test at these facilities. And lastly, there are various experimental anomalies which you can explain with light dark structure states, which you can test with fixed target experiments. So let me go in a little bit more detail for these three motivations. So if we start with an effective field theory approach, and we try to kind of list the different connections that new physics can have with a standard model, there's only a handful of light, sort of low-dimensional operators, only essentially three operators of dimension four and larger at dimension five and so on, where you can couple some new state in a Lorentz in a Poincaré invariant way to the standard model. These are kind of familiar things like vectors coupling to various currents in a standard model, Higgs portals, sterile neutrinos, and so on. So Maxime and collaborators in 2009 have shown that fixed target experiments can be kind of the most sensitive tools for probing operator dimensions that are less than around six. And this just comes from the fact that the intensities that you're able to achieve at fixed target experiments are very large. For higher dimensional operators, the energy scaling across sections is such that higher energies that are attainable at colliders win out. But for these low dimension connections, fixed targets can be the way to go. You can use the same operators to connect dark matter to the standard model, to the standard model and construct really simple models of dark matter freeze out in the early universe. So probably the simplest one that you can write down is some dark matter particles connected to electromagnetic currents via the dark photon. And this very minimal scenario can reproduce a correct relic abundance through the usual WIMP freeze-out mechanism that's familiar from kind of higher energy scales, but just translated to kind of the GeV scale and below. And the fascinating thing is that in this mass, dark matter mass coupling parameter space, the correct relic abundance is reproduced along these lines, which we call thermal targets, but they live below current existing bounds. But not so much below that you can't test them. In fact, you can probe them with future accelerator or fixed target experiments. So one example of such an experiment actually originates from Perimeter from the early 2013s. It's due to Eder Izaguirre, Gordon Krunyanich, Philip Schuster, and Natalia Toro, which is called the Light Dark Matter Experiment. The idea is you shoot a beam of leptons at a target, at a thin target, and measure the momentum of a recoiling electron. If there's something that has been produced, a dark state that doesn't interact with the detector, you measure a large amount of missing momentum. So this class of experiments is called missing momentum. This turns out to be a really powerful technique for probing the kinds of simple dark matter models that I've described. I'll show the projections in a second. But you know, this is a theorist sketch of what this experiment looks like. By now, there's an experimental collaboration that's formed around this idea. And it's been kind of well developed and it's underway. So this line here shows the projections for this experiment in terms of, I guess, of mass coupling parameter space. And you can see that essentially is able to probe this entire range between below roughly 100 MeV, so for dark matter mass. And when you combine it with other collider experiments, you can basically close off this entire possibility. So you can robustly test these very simple models of dark matter freeze-out. So I mean, this is just kind of one type of model. But one thing that became very clear in the last decade or so is that in addition to these minimal freeze-out models, there's an entire zoo of dark matter candidates, which can be produced from thermal contact with the Stan-Mall particles. So one set of examples that I worked on go by the name of strongly interacting massive particles. Here, the things that set the dark matter relic abundance are not these 2-to-2 annihilations to the standard model, but rather dark matter number changing processes that happen entirely within the dark sector. And the reason why this is interesting is because this sort of process is realized in a very different kind of theoretical construction. So the previous example were models that are weakly coupled. These kinds of interactions are relevant for strongly coupled models, for example, analogs of our QCD, but just translated to the dark sector. So there are many of these things, and they can feature very different signals compared to this missing momentum thing that I've talked about. So they need different kinds of fixed target experiments to probe them. Lastly, just as the last bit of motivation, there are various anomalies, probably the most prominent of which is the G-2, so the magnetic dipole moment of a muon. So this has to do with the electromagnetic coupling of photons to muons. The current observation appears to be at 4 or 5 sigma, incompatible with kind of some set of theoretical predictions. And there has been developments on that side which may reduce this discrepancy. But it was realized very early on that this can be explained with a new light state that can propagate in radiative corrections to the magnetic moment here. So the models that can explain this are, in principle, very simple. The minimal example that you can give is just something that couples two muons, and that's it. So in this case, the radiative correction fixes up your magnetic moment is just this. And this automatically implies that in collisions of protons with fixed targets, where you have lots of secondary particles like kaons and muons, you can emit these scalars just by virtue of them necessarily having a coupling to muons. So these scalars can be emitted, they can decay to muons or to photons through a loop of muons. You can potentially detect them. So one experiment that's kind of poised to potentially test or close some gaps in this parameter space for these very minimal models is called DarkWest. This is an upgrade of an existing experiment at Fermilab. And what this is an instrumented short baseline beam dump experiment where you have a proton beam colliding with a magnetized beam dump. and the products of this are detected downstream. So the whole experiment is only tens of meters long. And this gives you access to very short-lived particles. So this experiment is able to close off several gaps in the muon G minus 2 preferred region, which is shown by this green band in the coupling versus mass parameter space. So the sensitivity of dark west is basically this region, which is due to this paper by Diana Forbes et al. From last year, as well as some corners of parameter space here. And they require different kinds of analyses, but.
The LA64 already runs on the new moon?
I think you're right, but I think the number of muons on target they have is very low. At these experiments, you get basically one muon per proton collision, or a few muons per proton collision. So, just potentially more powerful. Okay, and lastly, we basically get a bunch of fixed target experiments for free because there's an intense effort to study neutrinos. Neutrino sources, like the Dune experiment, which is under construction, is a neutrino source. So it features a proton beam colliding with the target with some detectors downstream. This will happen for non-beyond 10-mile reasons. So we can use the same setups to search for BSM physics as well. Okay, so there's a decent science case for looking at fixed target experiments. And many of these are either operating or will be operating soon. So what's the catch? Why am I talking today? The basic challenge is that it turns out that the predictions of these experiments are a little bit tricky. Many experiments, like the Dune setup that I've shown before, feature detector, which is very far away from the target, which means it subtends a very small solid angle with respect to the target, which means that the signal rate, so the flux of dark sector particles or their decay products through the detector, is very sensitive to the angular distribution of that you compute. There are kind of three difficulties in predicting this this distribution. One is that it's sensitive to all the standard model physics that happens in the target that are responsible for producing the BSM states that you're interested in. This is a problem that's been studied for decades, and there are kind of well implemented solutions which go by the names of JAN, Fluca, EGS. But from a theorist point of view, because these codes have been in development for so long, they include so much physics, they're essentially a black box. So there are many approximations and simplifications that go into these simulations that we don't really understand. The second reason for why the predictions are difficult is that many of the processes that one is interested in studying, such as Bremsstrahlung, you're kind of interested in a kinematic regime where the differential rates are singular or almost singular, which makes them difficult for off-the-shelf tools like MadGraph to integrate. So you have to do something special to make stable predictions for rates. Finally, because all of these experiments have different shapes, sizes, beams, there's no standard tool chain really to study production of BSM particles at fixed target experiments, unlike collider physics, where kind of there's a well-developed tool chain, for example, MadGraph plus Pythia plus detector simulations to do the whole thing in one go. So the contribution of this work that I'm talking about today was a new Monte Carlo code, which aims to model some minimal set of standard model processes and beyond standard model particle production in a way that's easy to check, easy to modify. And what I want to emphasize is it's not a replacement for any of the tools that I mentioned in the previous slide, but it's rather a way to validate many of the approximations that have gone into developing those codes. And we'll see that, I think this is a worthwhile effort because it will reveal some interesting things about these existing software, which maybe wasn't well known before. So we focused on a very simple model, just as a as a kind of a compact example, which is just a new vector boson coupled to the electron current. This is not a UV complete scenario, but it can be easily embedded into a UV complete scenario. So what this allows us to do is to study kind of a finite set of production processes, both on the standard model side and on the BSM side. So on the standard model side, this allows us to focus on electromagnetic production. So we'll talk only about QED and ignore things that are complicated, like protons, proton Bremsstrahlung. So in principle, this means that you can compute everything perturbatively using standard quantum field theory methods, which is nice. So reproduction of these vectors would proceed like this. So imagine that we have a photon or some other charged particle propagating through a target. It undergoes various reactions like periconversion, Bremsstrahlung. And every time it does this, there's some small probability proportional to this coupling epsilon, which with which you can emit a dark sector particle. So given current experimental constraints on this parameter, on this dimensionless coupling epsilon, it has to be much smaller than 1, which means the probability of emitting a dark sector state is very small. So essentially, for reasonable energies and reasonable particle multiplicities, you only produce 1 particle per shower. And this allows for a significant simplification, which is that essentially you can factorize the production of the BSM particles from the standard model particles, which is useful because the standard model evolution is very expensive, which in turn means you can kind of reuse the same standard model shower to develop large statistics for your Beyond Standard Model simulation to get an accurate representation of the angular distributions in your detectors. So maybe this is kind of an obvious point, but this is not something that's been done, that's not commonly done. So for now, let me focus on the standard model part. So the thing that's expensive and that's been done for decades in existing codes. This is not the main goal of this work, but it turns out that by kind of studying the minimal set of standard model processes, we're able to find some interesting things about these pieces of software. So these codes allow you to simulate the propagation of standard model particles through a target. There's an enormous amount of physics that's built into them, but roughly the propagation follows the following steps. So we start out with some particle in our shower. It's propagated by some small amount, which is related to its bean-free path. You roll a dice at every step to determine whether a hard interaction took place. And if such an interaction took place, you sample the differential cross-section for the particles that might be produced in this interaction, add them to a shower. And then if it didn't take place, then you adjust the momentum to account for effects like ionization, multiple Coulomb scattering, which change the direction and energy of a particle. And then you repeat this process over and over again until all of your particles are irrelevant to your theory purposes. So their energy has fallen below some threshold, for example. So for electromagnetic cascades, which we're focusing on, there's only a handful of processes that are relevant, which is why we started with a simple example of something that couples to.
Hard code something like muon pair production by photon and so on, because this would be in the same category, it would be a very rare thing, superimposed.
Yeah, so that's actually kind of an interesting application of this piece of code that we've written, because you can, in principle, study that. You can generate those events very easily, as opposed to these things where it's hard. You have to bias their simulation to generate. So they do have them. I think it's implemented, but as I'll mention in a couple of slides, it's not. They don't always implement the right thing, or I'll just show it in a second. Yeah. So they definitely have pair production. So they both have muon pair production implemented, but whether they do it in a way that's correct is a question. I'm not sure. So for production from electromagnetic cascades, there's only a few processes that are relevant in the standard model part of a shower, which is preemption along and pair production. Then you have a bunch of 2-to-2 processes where electrons, photons, or positrons scatter and atomic electrons. And then you have Coulomb scattering and ionization. So these are basically subsets of these interactions, but they're so frequent that you have to model them separately. If you were to try to model every single discrete interaction, then your simulation would just take forever. So you have to model this. But in principle, these things you can compute from normal applications of QED. Well, the result of those calculations is a differential cross-section that depends on all of the phase space variables of the final states that you're interested in. In practice, it turns out that due to kinematic singularities in these differential cross-sections, the distribution is very peaky, which means it's very hard to treat numerically using standard Monte Carlo methods. So people resort to using many different approximations. And this can lead to some problems. So for the next couple of slides, I'll focus on the example of standard model Bremsstrahlung, which has a five-dimensional phase space. Five dimensions doesn't sound like a lot, but if you want to sample even a single event from a five-dimensional distribution in a shower, this can take seconds to minutes, depending on the precision that you're interested in, using kind of standard off-the-shelf integrators, Monte Carlo integrators. But you need to do this hundreds of times per single shower, so this would not work. So what people do is they marginalize all over all but one of the kinematic variables. So for example, they integrate the distribution for the outgoing electron, nucleon, and photon over all but the photon energy, for example. So you end up with one-dimensional distribution, which is a problem because you also need to reconstruct the kinematics of all the other ones, all the other particles in the final state. So let's compare the implementations, different implementations of standard model Bremsstrahlung in different codes. So this shows the transverse momenta of a photon on the x-axis and the transverse momentum of the outgoing electron on the y-axis. This is Jeant. You can see there's this amazing perfect correlation between these two kinematic variables, which looks very unphysical, because it is. If you were to do things right, and I'll explain what right means in a second, you get a much broader distribution where you do see some correlations, but there's no like perfect one-to-one equivalence between these two momenta. And if you do things in kind of like off-the-shelf tools, such as MadGraph, you get something that's sort of close to this, but it's difficult to integrate, so you have this sharp features in the phase space, which are not, again, not physical. And these may or may not be relevant to a given application. So what's going on here? Well, as I mentioned, the cross-sections for these processes, they can be computed fairly straightforwardly. So you can open Landau-Lifshitz and look up a cross-section, the differential cross-section for Bremsstrahlung. It has this complicated expression in terms of some parameters, which are related to the transverse momenta of the outgoing electron and photon. So it's some correlated distribution, but it's definitely not a one-to-one correlation like we see in all of the codes, Jeant, Fluca, and EGS. So these are very popular codes. Turns out what they do, and that's a little tricky to find, is that they literally set the transverse momenta of the electrons and photons to each other, because they're only able to sample from a one-dimensional distribution for the photons. So they're like, oh, well, what do we do for the electrons? Well, let's just set them equal. So that results in a distribution of electrons, but it's not quite correct. So they do it for a reason. And the reason is speed, because sampling from a one-dimensional distribution is very fast. The question is whether this approximation is important or not. So the answer is depends. I don't have a definitive answer. It depends on the situation. So in addition to the distribution, to the angular distribution that's imparted by the actual underlying Bremsstrahlung event, electrons and positrons propagating through material, they experience deflections due to multiple Coulomb scattering, just in the electromagnetic field of a nucleus, which also contributes a significant amount to the deflection, to the angular distribution of your standard model particles. So this typical angle, this multiple Coulomb scattering angle, scales with the square root of a distance that you've traveled in a target in units of the radiation length, as the square root scaling is characteristic of a random walk, which is what this is. And you can see with the typical momenta, or the typical angles that you experience from Bremsstrahlung and from multiple Coulomb scattering, they can be comparable, but it depends on the target thickness. So depending on what your situation is, and very thick targets, multiple Coulomb scattering will obviously win. But if you have a thin target, things might be incorrect. And as I mentioned, some of the thick target experiments do use fairly thin targets. So that might be a relevant thing that we need to investigate in the future. So in this code that we've put out, we kind of do a brute force thing. We sample for a full distribution. We had to do something mildly clever to get around the fact that it's extremely slow to sample from a single, like from a 5D distribution each time. So what we do is we have a set of pre-trained integrators at a grid of energies. Of course, in a shower, the energies that you find are completely random. They're not going to line up exactly with your grid. But you can use the important sampling algorithm to essentially use these functions to approximate, to sample from the actual cross-section at the energy that you're interested in, and get kinematics correctly this way. So specifically, basically, if you have some energy E that you want to simulate some hard event for, we find the next closest energy, but which we've pre-computed. Because it's a higher energy, this means that the phase space is larger, so you can use this basically as an upper bound on the cross-section that you're interested in, and use kind of standard Monte Carlo algorithms to get the correct kinematics fairly quickly. So this allows you to simulate the full distribution on the fly, which is nice.
Just out of curiosity, when you scatter many, many times, is there interference effects? So is there like number 1 or 2 or something like that?
So for Coulomb scattering, no, but there is an effect called the LPM effect, which is relevant for, this is actually Bremsstrahlung at very high energies, where you do have this interference, and this changes the scaling of the differential rate with energy.
And that's what LPM
one down for them to think. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So we didn't include that because we're focusing on energies below 100 GeV. This is, it turns out to be more relevant at higher energies. So we didn't include that, but yeah, that exists. Okay, so the standard model stuff was never like the main goal of our work because we're beyond standard model people, but we found something interesting anyway. So the BSM processes that we want to simulate in a fixed target also come with their own challenges. Some of them are related to the ones that I've described for the standard model. I'll give two examples of these challenges. So one example is, again, Bremsstrahlung of dark stuff. Here you have the same problems. The differential distribution is kind of singular and difficult to sample from, just like in the standard model. And the second example, which is also interesting, is positron annihilation. So electron-positron pairs can annihilate to produce dark sector states. This turns out to have a pretty tight interplay with a certain standard model processes, which I'll describe, which hasn't been, I don't think, appreciated before. Okay, so Brem is a really ubiquitous process, which is available almost whenever you have a coupling of a bosonic state to standard model particles. And it's easy to write down the differential rate for this using kind of standard quantum field theory rules. This obviously has some funny structure to it, so there are some nearly singular regions of phase space where the momentum exchanged can be very small between the nucleus and the propagating particle. So we have singularities in Q, we have singularities in the intermediate electron propagators, and this leads to a very peaky structure in the integrand. So here's a picture of along two of these kinematic variables. So you can see that the integrand is concentrated in some very small region of the phase space, and this is only two dimensions. You have to think about all the other ones as well. And again, this is hard to integrate, so people resort to approximations. And one commonly used approximation is called the Weizsäcker-Williams approximation. So you take this full Bremsstrahlung process, which is a 2 to 3 process, and you make the approximation that this intermediate photon is almost on shell. So it's Q. So the Q that appears here is the momentum of this photon. So we saw that the cross section peaks at Q squared very small. So this motivates approximating this photon as a real photon. And you reduce this 2-to-3 process to a 2-to-2 process, which is much simpler. So this is called the Weizsäcker-Williams or equivalent photon approximation. And it gets you within a factor of 2 or so of the total cross section. So here is a comparison of different cross section calculations for this process as a function of energy of the incoming beam for a fixed vector mass. So this dashed line is a Weizsäcker-Williams approximation, and these nearly overlapping lines are different numerical calculations. So in addition to Weizsäcker-Williams being off by a little bit, you also see that standard codes like MadGraph have something weird going on. We have, you know, inconsistencies as you vary, or fluctuations as you vary energy. And these are not statistical fluctuations. You can increase the number of events that you're simulating arbitrarily high, but there's some numerical instability in the code itself, which has to do with these nearly singular regions in the phase space. From a beyond standard model physics point of view, these kind of order one changes in the cross section, they don't really matter because we ended up taking a square root of the rate when we make projection plots as a function of mass and coupling of dark sector states, but it's something to note.
But it's also order one in the Young-Gravity distribution, the error, or just in the
problem? Yes, so distributions are much more important, which is what this slide is about. Angular distributions, as Daniel pointed out, are also very tricky. So because people don't want to integrate this whole five-dimensional thing, or sample from this five-dimensional thing, people have resorted to other tricks. So one trick that people have used is you can simulate standard model photon production very easily using these off-the-shelf codes. And then they basically rescale the distribution of standard model photons to mimic the distribution of these dark vectors. So specifically, they obtain some bin distribution of a photon as a function of energy, angle and energy. And then they rescale it by some angle independent factor, which they obtain from these codes like MadGraph, which again, as I mentioned, it might be, even that step might not be correct. So they start with some distribution as a function of energy and something that's a proxy for angle, the PT over PZ here, which looks like this. It may be a little hard to see. And they apply this rescaling, this phenomenological rescaling, to obtain a distribution that looks like this. So you can see that the weight is shifted to kind of higher energies. This dashed line is a proxy for some experimental acceptance. So for example, if your experiment accepts or detects dark photons below this line here, then for this distribution, you can see that most of the events lie below your acceptance. Angular acceptance is very high. This turns out to be not the right thing to do. In this case, the actual distribution, which we obtained from sampling the whole like exact tree-level differential cross-section, is much broader, and a large fraction of it lies above the acceptance. So the acceptance for the true distribution shown here is much, much smaller compared to this approximate rescaling approach. So this is like 40% or something for the example that I've shown before. This is an experiment called BDX, where the baseline of the experiment, so the distance between the target and the detector, is not that big. It's, I think, dozens of meters or something like that. But this problem, as you might imagine, is exacerbated when your detector is very far away from your target. So one example is Dune, where the near detector is 500 or almost 600 meters away from the target. And then you can run into real problems when you predict the yield of your dark sector states. You can be off by factors of 10 to 100. So this is a comparison shown here as a function of a dark vector mass. So our result is a solid line, and then, you know, there's a discrepancy between what people have computed in the inner literature. So you have to be careful when you make these approximations.
Remind me, is the main production mechanism for these panels?
Yeah, so that's a good question. There, I'll have a a plot that shows many different production mechanisms in a few slides or at the very end. There's also, for like a real dark photon, there will also be production from meson decays and proton Bremsstrahlung, which can be more relevant just because you have a ton of mesons. If you want to, so this is like very relevant for this maybe somewhat artificial example where you only couple to electromagnetic currents, but you can imagine things like anomaly-free LE minus L mu or LE minus L tau, where this would be one of the only relevant processes. Yeah, it's a good question. Okay, so what's going on with here? Kind of the story is the same as for the standard model case. The actual distribution is very different from the distribution of standard model photons. So this shows some factor that appears in the differential cross section for Brehm. So it has this structure. The thing to note here is that this is essentially maximized at a very different place compared to if you set this term proportional to MV to zero. So for standard model Brehm, where this term is absent, you're preferentially populating collinear and soft photons. Whereas for beyond standard model vectors, which are radiated from electrons, this term is super important. And instead, you have preferred emissions at basically the maximum available energy. So the dark vectors tend to absorb all of the energy of the incoming beam. And this is a generic feature of Bremsstrahlung of massive particles, which is very different from standard model Brehm. So not everyone uses this sort of ad hoc rescaling procedure. There are people who've used other approximations, like you can use the Weizsäcker-Williams approximation to sample the distribution, which is more correct. But if you're interested in the kind of the recoils of a nucleus, which are absent in this approximation, then you're into trouble. People have used kind of discrete sets of pre-simulated data and kind of drawing from those, which is, again, it's fine. But there's some ambiguity in these procedures that you implement. And one can use R code to check the validity of those approximations in principle. Okay, so the last beyond standard model example that I want to give where we think we learned something interesting is production of dark sector particles through annihilation. So by annihilation, I mean two different processes, roughly. So you have what people have called resonance annihilation. So E plus E minus annihilating to a dark vector with no other emissions. And people sometimes refer to this as associated production. So you produce a dark vector in association with a regular photon. And somewhat recently, people have realized that this is kind of an important production mechanism. It could be the leading production mechanism in some range of masses. And this is work due to Marciano et al., where they applied it to an old beamed up experiment called E137, which is what's shown here. So this, particularly this process, is a bit funny because if you were to compute the cross section for this at tree level, you find that it's proportional to a delta function. So just because this is a 2-to-1 process. And
sorry, what determines why the first process is dominating? And why is this such a narrow range where they dominate? It looks like the two are correlated. They dominate, there is a sharp cut off where they think.
Yeah, so.
So what sets that energy scale? Is it the electron? No, it's not.
Yeah, well.
What is it set by? The thing?
So. The upper edge will be set by the maximum energy of the beam that you have. So I think E137 used a 20 GeV beam. So that means the maximum mass, the maximum particle mass that you can produce is 2 ME. You have to do the fixed target kinematics, but it's MV squared over 2 ME. That's the maximum mass. So the upper edge is set by...
Is it the same experiment or?
Yes, it's the same experiment. Yeah.
And then the lower side is what?
This? Sorry.
The blue, E plus minus.
Yes.
There is a sharp cut off also on the low side.
And the low side?
Yeah.
That's a good question.
And there's a similar thing also in the Ridiculous of Mind.
It's a good question. It could have something to do with the. So E137 had an energy cut of order a GeV. And for E plus E minus annihilation, your energy that's inherited by the dark vector is equal to the, you know, to the energy of the incoming positron. So for these low masses, the resonant energy is lower, so it might just not pass the energy cut below this line. I think that's what's going on, but I'm not entirely sure.
Bizarre.
Yeah. So I think the thing that I'm going to talk about is going to smooth this out. I didn't make the same plot for the procedure that I'll describe in a second, but the reason why it looks bizarre is because you're artificially separating this process from this process, which is what we'll talk about next. But I was going to kind of raise a related point, which is that. So this is, this is a delta function. This is a very narrow resonance, which is fine. Like you have some distribution of positrons described by this function t, which they can simulate, interpolate it, and perform this integral. So this gives you some finite answer when you integrate the delta function. But when you start thinking about it just like a little bit, you have this infinite peak, and in reality, the positrons experience discrete energy losses. What's the probability of you hitting the resonance exactly, which is arbitrarily narrow, when your losses are discrete? It's
not very many positrons.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you have to have like an enormous sample in order to to hit this resonance. So the solution is that, or the solution to this kind of maybe puzzle, is that charged particles tend to radiate, and you can't stop them from radiating. They radiate preferentially soft and collinear emissions, which you'd think they'd cost a factor of alpha. But in fact, because of these collinear enhancements, the relevant expansion parameter is alpha times a log, which can be large-ish. So in fact, resonance annihilation can always proceed if you radiate enough soft and collinear photons.
Well, what are the electrons inside the target that distribute the velocity?
That's right. Yeah, so that's another effect that one could include here, the atomic motion of the electrons. We've considered it, but we didn't include it explicitly. I don't remember exactly why, but yeah. So this process is called radiative return, because if you start out with a higher energy positron beam, which couldn't annihilate resonantly at tree level, you can always emit enough photons to return to the resonance. So in this case, the calculation of a cross-section and of a differential cross-section is something that's familiar either from QCD or from leptase, if you remember, where you had radiative return to the Z resonance. So in this case, you can resum all of these soft and collinear emissions and write the cross-section for an arbitrary number of emissions in terms of what are essentially electron parton distribution functions. So these functions tell you about the fraction of linear momentum that are carried by the actual electrons when they collide. So these functions resum all of these emissions. So again, you can compute this. For once, you find a cross section that's actually a factor of a few larger, maybe 20% larger than what you would naively expect from a tree-level calculation, which is shown here. So this is the ratio of this radiative return process to the kind of a leading order tree-level calculation. So that's, again, the enhancement is nice, but it's nothing to write home about. What's interesting about this annihilation process is that the kinematics of the outgoing vector are completely determined by the incoming electron, just because it's everything else is collinear with it. But the relevant motion is the motion at the time of interaction. So if you start with some positron in your simulation at some, when it's produced by, let's say, pair production, it can propagate a significant distance before it undergoes this interaction to produce a dark vector by annihilating with an atomic electron. And while it propagates, it will experience deflections due to Coulomb scattering. So its direction at production will be very different from the direction at annihilation, which is not something that people have appreciated before. And this, again, leads to fairly different predictions for the angular acceptance of vectors that are produced in this way. So what I mean by this is that existing simulations of this process do the following. So they generate a sample of positrons using one of these off-the-shelf codes like Jant. And then they, you know, they use this to construct this distribution of positron energies and integrate the annihilation cross-section against this distribution. But this tells you the distribution at production, not at the interaction. And this gives rise to a very different angular distribution for the outgoing vectors. So these two histograms show the angular distribution as a function of Pt over Pz, so it's a proxy for the angle of emission. If you assume, if you take the direction of the vector to correspond to the initial positron direction, so the direction of a positron when it was first produced, versus sampling the distribution of the positron after it has propagated and finally interacted to produce the dark vector. These two dashed lines show kind of angular acceptances of Dune and another neutrino experiment called Argonaut. So you can see that below these lines, where you would expect to see signal, you have significant differences in the rate, again, just because of this angular acceptance issue. So in order to generate this curve, what we claim is the correct way to do things, we perform the following procedure. So we start out with some positrons from the standard model simulation, and we generate an interaction point according to this distribution. So this is telling us what is the probability of a positron to interact at a distance z plus dz from its production at z equals 0. And so this is the product of the interaction probability itself. So the BSM cross-section, in this case it's the annihilation cross-section, times this factor, which describes the probability to not have undergone a standard model interaction or any other interaction up to that point. So once we generate an interaction position, we can apply energy loss and multiple scattering to the positron, and then finally generate kinematics using the new direction Psamp. So this correctly assigns the direction of the momentum to the outgoing vector, which is independent of kind of a production, initial production direction of the positron. Okay, so this also turns out to have a bit of an effect on predicted fluxes at realistic experiments. So this is kind of a summary figure for what I've shown. These different panels show different experiments and some, you know, approximate, just a cut and count acceptance for dark vector production. What you should take away from this is, depending on who writes the paper, you get very different results just based on the approximations that they use. For example, in this paper, we agree quite well with predictions of these authors for their annihilation calculations as well as for their Bremsstrahlung calculations. In these papers, people have made a variety of approximations that turned out to be not hold water. So in this case, the predictions of Bremsstrahlung are dramatically different by one or two orders of magnitude. The positron annihilation is also quite different at low masses due to the effect that I've described, where the direction of a production is very different from a direction at annihilation.
It's always like the first papers are way too optimistic, and when you take into account more effects, you get more suppression compared to the...
Like, yeah,
it was the case with Weizsäcker and Williams, and I understood lacking angular distribution can lead to massive error.
Yeah.
Really, they're all overestimating the effects.
Yeah, I think I think the more reasonable people maybe had that intuition, but at least I certainly have placed a lot more trust into these codes because I didn't know how they worked. But now having seen how a sausage is made, it's a little horrifying. So, Well, for the radiative return, at least, the cross-section is enhanced by 20%, but for the other effects, it seems to go the other way. So the summary of my talk is that if you do things more carefully, you can get very different results for specifically angular distributions, and therefore the fluxes of dark sector particles through our detectors, and that's something we should keep in mind going forward. Here's a quick summary. Hopefully, you've convinced you that fixed target experiments are useful for a variety of reasons. Even in very simple, perturbatively calculable models, predictions of signal rates can be tricky for a variety of reasons, including difficulty with numerical implementations and the approximations used. And we've tried to address some of these problems with this paper. So we've highlighted a few different issues, and at some point we'll try to apply them to real experiments to see if any of this, any of these issues matter in practice. Thank you.
So, are there any further questions? Are you applying on protein beams and meson production? Tell you one thing that everyone is using in this BSM business. This proton Bremsstrahl, and I am personally have suspicions about it, because if you open the CERN data with muon pair production, there's a, like Dwellian and IQ squared, there is a meson fragmentation at long Q squared, describes the paper, data beautifully. There is no room anywhere for the proton Bremsstrahl that everyone is using. Mm-hmm. So I have deep-seated suspicion that it's much of it is bogus.
Yeah, Marco brought this up during lunch. We haven't thought about doing it, but as you probably know, Adam Ritz and his former students are still thinking about that stuff. So I think we're trying to compare it to vector meson production data, but it's very hard.
I forgot the number of that experiment. NA60 on NA61, there was like a dedicated 400 GeV measuring like the distribution of time.
Yeah. So, no, that'd be
interesting. You look at the data, there's lots of wiggles, right, on level from various mesons. It fits the model they have with just mesonic production. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'd be interested in looking at that. You're right. For
I referee a paper just a couple of days ago that describes like fantastic new results using the proton Bremsstrahl. I said everything is fine. I like your paper, but can you explain the existing data?
Even simpler than that, there's some paper that was trying to make use of pi on Bremsstrahl, and they're trying to use chiral perturbation theory for emissions that are like of order a GeV, where chiral perturbation theory is like clearly incorrect. So people do all kinds of fun things. At least for proton Brem, you can parametrize uncertainties with some form factors, which you have no control over, but you can vary the parameters. And but using these kinds of data sets would be really useful.
There is clearly a fragmentation from various mesons, but the pair production is a very rare process, right? Of if it's not from mesons, right? So it can be added the same way as yours.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of a small perturbation on the way.
Exactly. Yeah. We were talking about doing that. I think it would be a nice kind of standard model application of this.
Other questions? Okay, maybe I've got one. Mm-hmm. So, can you like modify like how difficult would it be to add, let's say, like some a form factor for the full nucleus to get like coherent production?
So all of our processes involve, like that involve nuclei, have form factors built in.
Yeah, so you are always like coherent.
Well, it depends on the Q squared and the, yeah, it's taken into account. Oh, the form factors are also interesting. There's been an error in the literature that's been propagating where a certain form factor is squared instead of not squared, which is the correct thing. It turns out it appears in a place that doesn't really matter that much for most calculations, but it's still kind of a big error.
It should be squared, or it should not be?
It should not be squared. Yeah. It goes back to this paper by Bjorken et al. From 2008. Yeah. And yeah, it's been copied and pasted.
But on their part, it was a typo?
I think it's a typo, yeah. But nobody checked the typo for a long time.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But it's a good typo to make because it's in a place that doesn't matter.
So, questions from Zoom? So we can thank the speaker again.